TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
The JFK Assassination and the Gangster Nature of the State by Michael Parenti. This archival recording is a tribute to John F. Kennedy, who was killed on November 22, 1963. And it's also a tribute to the historian and political scientist Michael Parenti. Parenti criticized the lone assassin theory and addressed the bitter question that still haunts so many, whether government agencies of a democratic country would do such a thing as assassinate an elected president.
When Oliver Stone's movie JFK opened in December 1991, a huge PR campaign was mobilized against the film. Even progressives spoke out. Noam Chomsky wrote in support of the Warren Commission's findings. In contrast, Michael Parenti gave one of his highly acclaimed talks criticizing the lone assassin theory. In the talk that you're about to hear, Michael Parenti turns to that question first. He examines what he calls the gangster nature of the state. He spoke in Berkeley on the 30th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Michael Parenti.
I've been looking at history, and I've been impressed and depressed by the fact that history is really a chronicle of immense atrocities. What we have in history is the fact that when surplus value develops, when there's more than a subsistence economy, you have some portion of the population that will do everything it can to enslave and to expropriate the labor of the rest of the people. Whether it's a slave society, as in ancient Greece and Rome, or feudal society where people were reduced to serfs, or in a capitalist society where people are driven to the edge of insecurity and made to work faster and harder. And one of the things that's used in that arrangement is a very conscious instrument of control that's very necessary. And that instrument is called the state. That is, what they do is set up a state, an organization that has a, as Max Weber, who wasn't a Marxist, as Max Weber called it, an organization that has a monopoly on the legitimate uses of force and violence, on the use of legitimate force and violence. But that's what we have today. We also have developed in modern times some democratic features, some means of trying to fight back and restrain this arbitrary power. What are we trying to say? That along with government, we also have a thing called the state. And along with governance, along with policies, and along with those things, we have this other instrument, even in a democratic state. And that instrument, whether it's in democratic France, or democratic England, or democratic Germany, or democratic Italy, or democratic USA, or democratic Canada, and all these countries, all of them have these other instruments and agencies that act like a bunch of gangsters, that act repressively, that use surveillance, that use every dirty trick in the book, unequal enforcement of tax laws, name it. The bringing in of drugs into whole neighborhoods and communities, trumped up murder charges, assassination. And that you have in the middle of these democracies, you have the state within the state known as the national security state. And that state is capable of the most unspeakable crimes that you can think of. And those crimes are perpetrated against their own people. They're perpetrated against people all around the world. Not long ago, I got a letter from a woman who's been a community organizer in Chicago. And she said with grief in her heart, she said, I remember the 60s. I remember the tremendous democratic organization and leadership that was developing in the Latino and African-American communities. And I remember those leaders, and every single one of them today is either dead, shot by the police, or in Marion prison on trumped up charges. And I remember the demoralization that took place, the shattering of those organizations. And after those organizations were shattered and demoralized, then in came the drug traffickers. And those drug traffickers, the thing I remember the most about them is that they were aided and abetted by the feds, by the federal agents themselves. And this is what happens. That is, we are dealing with a state that was engaged in domestic counterinsurgency, and it was more interested in having a population that was unorganized and demoralized than a population that was organized, that was effectively fighting for its democratic rights. Because if it's organized and it's effective and it's powerful, it will start making demands and start pursuing its interests, and it will start cutting in on the interests that those police and those coppers and those undercover people and those forces of military and law and order are dedicated to protecting the status quo, protecting those with property against those who don't have it. And by the way, for the last 1,000 years, we've had theorists who've made that point, except they make it proudly. Adam Smith said, as the divisions of property become increasingly unequal, it is more and more necessary to have a state to defend those who have property from those who do not. John Locke, the purpose of the state is to defend those who have property from those who do not. James Harrington, you can go on, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton. The only difference was that when Marx said it, he said, to defend those who have property from those whose labor is expropriated by those who accumulate wealth off their labor, who have all the property. He changed it a little bit. And he said it wasn't just haves and have-nots, it was haves taking it from those who produced it and created the haves. And throughout the world, dominant economic interests today have enlisted the efforts of assassins and torturers. As we talk at this moment, the CIA and other such agencies in this country and other countries have sponsored violence, torture, death squads, drugs in scores of countries, from Zaire to Angola to Mozambique to El Salvador to Guatemala to Indonesia to East Timor, and you go on and on and on, all through to Western Europe, to the USA, to Chicago and Detroit and Boston and New York. They have systematically targeted, in many countries, the clergy, the peasant leaders, intellectuals, journalists, student leaders, labor union leaders, workers, and any community activists and such. Tens of thousands have been murdered and assassinated to prevent social change, to destroy any kind of redistributive politics, any kind of government, any kind of social movement that is not willing to reduce its people to economic fodder. And with NAFTA, with the North American Free Trade Agreement, we now see the third worldization of the USA will continue full speed ahead. The gangster nature of the state is cloaked by the democratic facade and by the democratic substance of the government. I mean, there is some democratic substance there. Democratic victories have been won. We have struggled, and certain things have been won. And yet, in the midst of this, this state still goes on. And what is so compelling about an issue like drugs, as Michael Levine is pointing out, is that it's not that we're saying the government is not doing enough about drugs, or that we're losing the war against drugs. It's that the government or elements in it are active perpetrators and purveyors of drugs. And what it is so compelling about the JFK assassination is how nakedly the gangster nature of the state is revealed. It is an awakening. And to know the truth about the JFK assassination is to create a delegitimating force that calls into question the entire state system and the entire social order it represents. And this is why, for 30 years, the mainstream press has suppressed or dismissed out of hand the findings about JFK's death. The findings of independent investigators like Peter Dale Scott, Harold Weisberg, Carl Oglesby, Mark Lane, Anthony Summers, Philip Melanson, Jim Garrison, Cyril Wecht, and dozens of others. They're called assassination buffs. They're not buffs. Even that word is a limiting and marginalizing and diminishing term. A buff is a kind of a hobby pursuer, you see. It's a kind of a quirky person who follows quirky little interests. Would you talk about Holocaust buffs, would you? No. They are serious investigators of a very serious crime, which leads to all sorts of serious understandings about the criminal nature of the state. And this is why they relentlessly, the mainstream media and the opinion leaders and the political leaders of this country, relentlessly attack or ignore this literature. And this is why they give fulsome, gushing, ready publicity to the likes of Gerald Posner with his book Case Closed, which got put into every major magazine. I couldn't put the TV on all week without seeing this guy's face and hearing him blather these kind of cliche statements whose credibility are dependent on you being totally ignorant of what the investigators for 30 years have been uncovering and the questions that have been raising. And who did a grotesque, idiotic whitewash of the whole thing. And this is why they savaged Oliver Stone's movie, JFK, a movie that was very accurate about the specifics of the murder. A movie that reached millions of people, that broke through that thing that they were keeping down. The only movie in the history of Hollywood, and I wrote a book called Make Believe Media, which is about TV and films, so I think I know something about films. At least I did spend the better part of a year reading a lot of literature. It's the only movie that I know of that was attacked 6 months before it was ever released. In the Washington Post and in the New York Times and in Time and Newsweek, and attacked relentlessly for a year after it was released. And this is also why in this past week they kept up the relentless propaganda campaign with the 30th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination to show that Oswald was the lone assassin. And they're always limiting the question, just as the Warren Commission did a priori, was Oswald the lone assassin? Did he act alone? Did he or did he not act alone? Meanwhile, all the serious investigators have a different question. It's not that. He was not at all one of the people who shot Kennedy. He did not act at all, although he was involved in another way. He was involved as a fall guy. And this is why they do this. If you want to know why, you just listen to them. It's not my analysis. It's what they say. The propagandists of the right and the center know why they've got to trash this issue and contain it. Listen to what Tom Wicker of the New York Times had to say. Now, Tom Wicker, he's never written a movie review in his life. JFK came out, and Tom Wicker, who is a columnist, a Washington columnist for the New York Times, suddenly became a movie reviewer. And instead of getting the usual movie review length of 800 words, he got 2,000 words. It's a whole page with pictures and all that. And in that review, he tells us that if the, quote, wild assertions in Oliver Stone's movie are taken at face value, Americans will have to accept the idea that most of the nation's major institutions conspired together and carried out Kennedy's murder. In an era, Wicker goes on, in an era when mistrust of government and loss of confidence in institutions, the press not the least, are widespread and virulent, such a suggestion seems a dubious public service. So truth or not truth has nothing to do with it. He's saying the question is institutional legitimacy. Wicker understands the heart of the matter. A full revelation about the murder would be a serious attack upon the legitimacy of the dominant institutions of state and class, the press not being the least of one of those institutions, a faithful servant of it. The system that New York Times writers faithfully defend. Playing before mass audiences, the movie JFK did not finger a cabal of malevolent perpetrators, but in fact pointed the finger at the national security state itself as the murderer. Damage control. You know, back in 1978, the House Select Committee reported, in fact, after an investigation, that there was more than one assassin shooting Kennedy. And there, therefore, was a conspiracy. In response, the Washington Post immediately editorialized in 1978, quote, could it have been some other malcontent whom Mr. Oswald met casually? It gets better. Could not as many as 3 or 4 societal outcasts with no ties to any one organization have developed, in some spontaneous way, a common determination to express their alienation in the killing of President Kennedy. It is possible that two persons acting independently attempted to shoot the president at the very same time. It is possible. It's not at all likely. So sometimes those who deny conspiracies create the most convoluted fantasies of all. David Garrow, who wrote a biography of Martin Luther King, benignly, patronizingly looks at you, at the public mind, and he says that the evidence pointing to a conspiracy to murder Martin Luther King, a large majority of the American people do believe in assassination conspiracies. That allows events to have large, mysterious causes instead of small, idiosyncratic ones. I would say the Washington Post had the most mysterious cause of all a few minutes ago. They like that. They like the large causes. You see, but the question of conspiracy, it has to be decided by an investigation of evidence, not by a priori, unscientific, and patronizing presumptions about the public mind. In any case, the evidence in King's assassination doesn't involve large, mysterious causes, but very immediate actualities. And the investigators, like Peter Dale Scott and Harold Weisberger and Mark Lane, they weren't impelled by some yearnings, you see. They were impelled by questions of evidence, by things that didn't just seem to make sense, by very immediate empirical things which drew them into this more and more. But which these people, who never read that evidence, don't have to deal with, and so they can fashion all these theories. The independent investigators demolished the Warren Commission. The first and most effective, perhaps, was Harold Weisberg's book, Whitewash, and then the other one by Mark Lane, Rush to Judgment. Right there, terrific, written 25 years ago. Let's focus on a small part of the actual conspiracy. I can't obviously go through it all. It would take ages. Let's start with Oswald. If you watch television this week, you again, for the 78th time, heard that Oswald was a loner, an incompetent, not very bright. You heard he was emotionally disturbed. Gerald Posner got on there, turning instant psychiatrist, and he said, Lee Harvey Oswald was a very disturbed young boy. He had a very disturbed childhood, and he was a passive aggressive. I said, a passive aggressive? A passive aggressive assassin? How does that work? That explains why he used a rifle which couldn't shoot straight. He also was a leftist. Alexander Coburn has joined the right and the center, and in a column in the Examiner said he was a leftist. The truth is something else. Lee Harvey Oswald, all his IQ tests show that he was above average intelligence. He was a bright guy, a quick learner. Lee Harvey Oswald spent most of his adult life not as a lonely drifter, but directly linked to the U.S. intelligence community. At the age of 18 in the U.S. Marines, he had secret security clearance, and he was working at Marine Air Control in Atsugi Base in Japan. Atsugi was a top secret base where the CIA launched some of its U-2 flights and did other kinds of covert operations in China. The next year, at the age of 19, he was assigned to El Toro Air Station in California with security clearance to work radar. And here he emerged, certain strange things began to happen. He emerged as a babbling Russophile and Soviet communist. He started playing Russian language records at blast level in his barracks. He started addressing his fellow Marines in Russian. He read Russian books and touted Soviet communism as, quote, the best system in the world. He called his fellow Marines comrades. Now, the U.S. Marine Corps in 1958 was not exactly known as a bastion of liberal tolerance and free thinking. My buddy Bernard Livingston wrote a book called Closet Red. He tells of his experiences in the Army where they had to filter out anybody who had funny opinions, who had pinko-ish opinions or whatever else, they had to be reported. That the Army constantly, and I'm sure the Marines, constantly surveils anybody who might outspokenly or actively begin to say or act certainly in the way he did. But in this instance, Oswald's Marine commanders didn't mind. He kept his security clearance. He kept all the radar records. He could see what was going in and out and knew all about the things that were happening there. And he, a wealth of sensitive radar information and other highly sensitive information from sensitive bases, black operations as they were called. Well, if Oswald was a Soviet spy or a Cuban spy, as some people now claim, he certainly had a novel way of building a cover. Other odd things began happening. In February 1959, Lee Harvey Oswald failed the Marine Corps proficiency test in Russian. 6 months later, he was practically fluent in Russian. Only in 1974, a document that was dislodged from the Warren Commission that had been secreted thanks to Howard Weisberg's legal efforts got the document out. It was shown that Oswald had attended the U.S. Army Monterey School of Languages. Now, Monterey is not open to anyone who just happens to have a hobby, a language hobby. You go only for serious training, and you are sent by the government, and it must be related to government work in a language picked by the government, which is related to specific assignments. So Oswald learned Russian at the U.S. Monterey School of Languages. Another odd thing, Oswald was given an early discharge from the Marines because his mother had injured her foot. That's called a dependency discharge. Your parent needs you. A jar had fallen on her toe. And he was immediately, he put in the request and he got it within a week. His fellow Marines were astonished at the velocity of the release. It also so happened that the jar fell on her foot a year before the discharge. But she was having, it wasn't healing right, you know. This was only one of a number of very strangely favorable treatments that the U.S. government began to give Lee Harvey Oswald. He then defected to the USSR. But how? Philip Melanson raises the question. To get to Russia in those days, it would have cost $1,500. Lee Harvey Oswald's bank account showed a deposit of only $203. He got, after he arrived in London and was there, he left London and went to Helsinki on October 11. On a day when there were no available commercial flights that would have allowed him to make it in one day. He had some kind of private transportation to get to Helsinki. In Russia, he announced that he was renouncing his U.S. citizenship and that he had lots of secrets that he was going to give to the Soviets. He even went into the U.S. embassy and announced that and made sure they all knew it. The Soviets didn't bite. They let him stay, but they at no time thought he could be an agent of any use to them. They kept him under constant surveillance. He worked in a factory. He showed no particular interest in guns, but he belonged to the factory's gun club. He used to join in the rabbit shoots, and he could never hit the rabbit. Always someone had to come behind him and shoot the rabbit while he was firing, otherwise they would have been there all day. It was a joke. He was a miserable marksman, as he had been in the U.S. Marines. He had been flagged again and again he missed the whole target a number of times. You get the flag. So Lee Harvey Oswald's show was couldn't hit the side of a barn. Now, if Lee Harvey Oswald was really a defector and not a U.S. spy, then U.S. intelligence could well have taken the view that his was one of the most damaging defections in history. Now, what's done in all defections, especially those connected with government and military, is that there's a damage assessment. No damage assessment was ever made on Oswald's defection. This did come out in the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee. Why was there was no damage assessment? I guess it was just overlooked. We don't know. After 2.5 years, he applies to return to the U.S. This is after renouncing his citizenship, announcing he was going to give away secrets. And instead of being grabbed when he comes out and tried as a traitor, the U.S. accepts him back. And he says he was never debriefed. In fact, he was debriefed in Holland, in Amsterdam, but the CIA has no record of debriefing him, doesn't know who he is, never touched him, was never near him. And their explanation before the commission was that there were so many tourists coming in and out, that there was nothing particularly about him that would catch our attention. One might wonder, what is needed to catch your attention? A defector, secrets, all that. After the assassination, the CIA claimed that they suspected that he was a Soviet spy. They still didn't debrief him then. That makes it even more curious. He gets out of Russia, and what does the State Department do? They give him money. They give him money to travel back to the U.S. and get set up. They pay all his travel and moving expenses and those of his wife's. He's given back his passport with full rights to travel anywhere and denounce the U.S. government again someplace else. His wife is exempted from usual immigration quotas. No waiting. No exclusion for having belonged to the Soviet Komsomol, which is the Communist Youth Organization, which is a violation of U.S. immigration laws. Yet she was allowed in. Once back in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald settles in under the wing of one George Demorenschild, a right-wing Russian with CIA ties. And this begins a whole pattern that goes on in Dallas and New Orleans, namely, the forays out into the public eye as a leftist.
You heard part one of a one-hour talk by Michael Parenti entitled The JFK Assassination and the Gangster Nature of the State. In his book, Dirty Truths, Parenti gives more details about George Demorenschild. He was part of a network of Russian exiles contracted by the CIA. Demorenschild was also an associate of oil millionaires H.L. Hunt and Clint Murchison, and there exists a correspondence between George Pappy Bush and Demorenschild. The Warren Commission identified him as the person closest to Lee Harvey Oswald before the assassination. Demorenschild died by a gun blast to the head 3 hours after a House Assassinations Committee investigator tried to contact him. Come back for part two of this program when TUC Radio returns. Michael Parenti is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts. He has taught at colleges and universities in the United States and abroad. With roots in a working-class Italian district of New York and a PhD in political science from Yale, Michael Parenti has become an internationally known lecturer. An extended text of this talk can be found in Parenti's book, Dirty Truth, published by City Lights. This archival recording is being rebroadcast in November 2024, 61 years after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, when so many questions raised still not have been resolved, and while issues of the gangster nature of the state and unequal wealth distribution may have even become more timely. It's also a tribute to Michael Parenti, the internationally known political scientist, historian, and activist, who has since retired. This is one of Parenti's most highly acclaimed talks, ending with a standing ovation. He spoke on the 30th anniversary of the assassination. Come back for part two when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. My name is Maria Gleuden. Thank you for listening.